Chief Justice Steele, Justice Harlan, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely. I'm Joseph Leger. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent the defendant appellant here today, Kevin Forehand. Does the court require a brief recitation of the procedural history of this case before I begin argument?
I do not, but apparently not.
Thank you. With the court's permission, I am going to begin with what I'm going to call the rational basis argument. The appellant is essentially arguing that the legislature either acted completely irrationally or through the course of events and the passage of these various statutes that all interplay with each other, an ambiguity arose as to how they really wanted to treat this offense of escape after conviction under Section 1253. 1253 was passed with the code revisions in the 1970s and really has remained quite unchanged. It's a paragraph statute, unlike many of our other statutes where various grades of the offense are subdivided into to A, B, or 1, some form of subsection manner. Here we have a paragraph that simply describes three different crimes and goes on to describe the level of punishment associated with each one. One being a Class D felony, one being a Class C felony, one being a Class B felony. Obviously, the potential sentences for each of these crimes is drastically different depending on what facts are present for the case and what it qualifies as. And in this case, we simply have someone who did not return to the time and place designated by the Department of Correction. He was in custody. From a purely legal perspective, he was in constructive custody. It didn't matter that the Department of Correction did not exercise any kind of physical control over him, ankle bracelet, anything of that nature. He was in custody from a legal perspective.
Well, your client committed the crime of escape. I mean, that's not disputed, correct?
That's not disputed, Your Honor.
Okay. And it's not disputed that in this particular case, that crime was not accompanied by violence in any form, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Our argument is,
and
it's
also the case that the statute that delineates or enumerates all of the offenses that are deemed to constitute a violent crime are enumerated in that specific piece of legislation. This is 1253. I can't recall which.
Title 11, 4201C lists the violent felonies,
right, Your Honor. And escape is included among those numerous offenses that are listed there.
Yes, Your Honor. The legislature.
Okay. And your argument is that the listing, the inclusion of that particular offense constitutes both a substantive due process violation and a cruel and unusual punishment constitutional violation.
Correct, Your Honor. The D felony only. The defendant narrows this argument considering the extraordinary remedy that the defendant is seeking to only the D felony portion of that statute being
labeled. All right. In other words, only when the statute is used for purposes of habitual offender status.
With respect to the operation of 4214A and the resulting minimum mandatory crime, that happens here, but defendant's position is that it is not a substantively violent offense, period.
Right.
That it's just irrational to call it that.
Okay, well, you know, as limited in the way you've described, we would still have to determine whether or not either of those provisions of the Constitution is violated by the inclusion of escape in 4201C. Is that right?
Well, consistent with the court's duties to construe
right?
as narrowly as possible, all the court has to do is decide whether labeling this particular crime was irrational. And the result.
That's my next question. What exactly is your due process argument?
Well, under substantive due process, which comes from both the federal and state due process clauses, as the state describes, a poorly blunt tool to attack a criminal statute. However, sometimes it is the only tool that a defendant has left to attack what the legislature has done and whether or not their decision-making process was rational, whether or not it was done in such a way that it makes sense or that
Do you agree that rationality is the standard?
Well, rational basis is the standard, Your Honor.
Okay.
Correct.
And what precisely is the reason, in your client's view, that they were, that the legislature had no rational basis to include escape in Section 4201C?
The sequence of events, the big picture, Your Honor. When the legislature initially promulgated 1253, they took great care to describe three very different crimes, and that happened at a time when, whether it was violent or not, was purely a sentencing consideration pursuant to the court's discretionary sentencing powers, you know, an aggravating factor, if you will. There was no interplay with other statutes to create minimum mandatory sentences occurred here or any other kind of mandatory results, which completely strips away the court's discretionary
Can you boil that down
process.
To a sentence? Because I don't understand exactly what you're saying.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I will try to simplify my argument. The legislature passed 1253 quite some time ago. At that point in time, whether it was violent or not, it didn't matter. It had no collateral effect with by operation of other statutes. That was simply an issue, a substantive issue in front of the sentencing judge. Subsequent to that, the legislature desired to change the habitual offender statute and aggressively penalize habitual offenders under the code, and as part of that, they adopted a list of so-called violent felonies, and now suddenly the idea of whether something's a violent act or not has significant consequences, automatic mandatory consequences. Now, that happened quite some time later in 1996. Our position is, through the course of these events, the legislature did not really pay attention to what it was doing. It never looked at 1253 again and said,
how are we to determine on this record whether or not this legislature actually paid attention? That is, isn't the legislature presumed to have paid attention and to have made a deliberate decision? That deliberate decision may or may not have constitutional consequences. But your argument, as I understand it, is that we have to look to what the legislature actually did and peer into the minds of everyone who voted to do that.
No, Your Honor, we're not arguing that the court has to pry into the subjective thought process of the legislature. What we're suggesting is that under the substantive due process analysis, which is truly a question of fairness, does this seem fair and rational? Is the result something that appears to have been intended? And we would suggest that it's clear from the synopsis of the 4210C adoption that they simply adopted SENTAC's list of violent felonies in toto, just adopted it without really any – there's no evidence that
why does that make it? Why does that make it irrational?
Because there is some obligation on the legislature's part to reconcile or at least look at independently what they're doing. It's for the court to decide whether what happened here is an ambiguity or an irrational act. Our position is simply when they adopted the SENTAC felony list, clearly they simply did so in toto. It was something that was ready-made and convenient to adopt. The SENTAC body, to some extent, is the voice of the legislature. However, it's not dispositively the voice of the legislature because that body is comprised of various representatives from the executive
judiciary. Let me cut through this and ask you the question very pointedly. Does your due process argument focus on the process by which the General Assembly enacted 4201C?
No,
or,
Your Honor.
Or does it focus on the result of what they did?
I'm sorry, I was unclear about this. It focuses on both. The first question is the result.
I'm sorry?
The first argument is the result is just completely irrational. The second
argument is why is it completely irrational? The result as opposed to the process.
Well, under a fairness view, because this is about the court's sense of fundamental fairness and whether what the legislature has done here is appropriate, this person simply did not return to the time and place designated. There was no other facts incident to the crime. That's all they did. Is it fair? Is it rational that this results in a minimum mandatory penalty that arises by operation of statute automatically and removes completely from the decision maker any discretion, any view of the facts of the case, any of those traditional elements associated with sentencing? Is that rational for what defense called on numerous occasions a curfew violation? perhaps curfew violation was a little extreme. Defense suggested that by calling it that, it wasn't to say that this was not legal custody. It was simply to emphasize that substantively this is what happened here. He was AWOL, which is probably a better phrase.
As I understand your argument, Mr. Leger, it is that the legislature wholesale took the phrase escape after conviction, placed it in a list of violent crimes which would trigger habitual offender status, I guess is a better word, at some point for an individual without discriminating between whether the three forms of escape after conviction possible under the statutory framework actually involve violence or not. And the three are B, C, and D felonies. B involves injury to someone in the course of an escape, which is obviously a violent crime. C is armed with a weapon while consummating the escape, which implies violence. But the D felony, the least of the three, encompasses a wider range of escape after conviction, including simply not returning to a halfway house. And the assumption is people would not be placed in a halfway house by the Department of Correction if there was a view that they were violent. They wouldn't be released into the community. So my understanding of your argument is no rational legislature would have placed that level of escape after conviction in a list of violent crimes. And having done so, because of the triggering consequence, it violates substantive due process, both in the procedure that they used of just wholesale incorporating it without discriminating between the three forms of escape after conviction, and then in the actual application because of the harsher sentence that's triggered. Now, are you going to touch after that on the Eighth Amendment argument that you have about cruel and unusual punishment?
I will briefly, Your Honor. Obviously, defense counsel feels that the substantive due process argument is the strongest, and with the court's permission, I would like to address some of the things you just brought up. It is our argument that what happened here fails the substantive due process test. The expansion of the statute again in 2003 to capture, based on the synopsis, just as much circumstance, place, scenario as possible it shows that they're expanding it to capture as much conduct as possible, but no one's taking the time to say, wait a minute, this is three crimes in one statute, which is a little unusual based on how so many of the statutes are subdivided in a more orderly way. Here we have simply three crimes created in a paragraph. No one's ever really looked at this as they went along through each step, the 4102C list being adopted, the subsequent greater expansion of the statute itself, and ultimately it captures the act of AWOL, which we argue is just not a violent act. It just is not violent.
Can it lead to a violent act?
Being AWOL in and of itself, I don't believe so. I, to the extent it leads to a violent act, I believe that's what the Class C and B felonies are for, to capture that conduct.
How about efforts to recapture an escapee who's on the run?
That's part of the statute, Your Honor. The language actually captures a crime committed during the escape. I think that, if I recall correctly, that aggravates the escape if they commit additional crimes while they're on escape status. Now, I may be mistaken about that, but my recollection is you have the threat of force, display of a weapon, those things, then you have the injury, which is the greatest, most violent form of the offense under subsection B. And the injury sentence captures injury apprehending them as well as any injury caused, as I read it, to anybody while they're on escape status, injuring anybody. But that's how that language is to be construed is completely something for another day and not at issue here, so I did not focus on
that. Does that analysis within the statute itself recognize that escape can lead to violence?
The greater grade of the offense, yes, and I think that goes back to the point where the legislature took great care when they originally drafted the statute to create three very different offenses with three very different penalty ranges, the most violent having a minimum mandatory of 2 to 25 years, but a minimum mandatory of 2 years. And that's where it kind of gets...
Is there a rationale for other statutes that are listed, for instance, burglary or weapons offenses, while those in and of themselves can be peaceful offenses, to use that phrase, it can lead to violence. And so if an offense can lead to violence, is it irrational for the legislature to describe it as a violent felony?
That is the question the court ultimately has to decide, because that is part of the substantive due process. The legislature calls burglary a violent offense, at least burglary second. My recollection is burglary third is not described as violent. But in any event, that's a judgment they made. Here they made that judgment and labeled the entire statute, all three grades, violent. Is the possibility of violence enough to satisfy due process, that violence could arise and that's good enough? Defendant disagrees.
Well, that could apply to careless driving.
That's exactly why defendant disagrees. The possibility of is too broad a sword to decide whether something's violent or not for substantive due process analysis. And especially, whereas the case is here, you're triggering automatic minimum mandatory penalties by operation of the interplay between the statutes.
You don't dispute that escape after conviction that would constitute a Class C or a Class B felony would be a violent offense included under 4201C?
No, Your Honor. The defense is only attacking the Class D part of the statute being labeled violent. The defendant does not contend any other portion of 4201C's list. The defendant doesn't contend the Class C and B, which defendant agrees appear substantively violent based on the language of the statute. Only the D felony, which has been increased over the years to just capture everything, a defendant walking away from the hospital bed, however they manage to elude the correction officers that may have them in their custody, but any location where a defendant is, if they disappear, they are now guilty of a violent offense, though no other conduct may have occurred, no injury, no weapons, no force, no anything. The guards could have been at fault, walked away, and the person simply disappeared. They are wrong to engage in the conduct, which is why it's a crime. But is it violent?
I know you don't think your Eighth Amendment argument is as strong as your substantive due process argument, but you're running out of time.
Very well, Your Honor. And with respect to the Eighth Amendment, again, it ties in and dovetails with the due process rationality. Is 8-year minimum mandatory sentence, is that just cruel and unusual for, again, substantively a curfew violation, going AWOL, you know, leaving the parameters of the permission that you've been given with respect to the halfway house or any other quasi-incarcerated setting or monitored setting? 8 years minimum mandatory just seems excessive for the conduct. Now, this case is a little different from Crosby in that here we have a minimum mandatory trigger, and that's what the judge gave the defendant, simply gave him the minimum mandatory required by law. But that illustrates how no one could exercise any independent decision-making here. It's simply a penalty that was required by the interplay and operation of these statutes. It didn't matter what the sequence of events was, what anything the defendant did, the facts of the case.
Let me interrupt. Are you arguing that the Eighth Amendment is implicated simply by the fact that this is a mandatory sentence?
No, Your Honor. I'm simply acknowledging that this is a very different case from Crosby, and that here we have a judge who imposed a midman where there was no independent decision-making by the judge. Whereas,
what bearing does that have on an Eighth Amendment analysis?
Under Crosby, and I'm simply trying to address how Crosby differs from the case in front of Your Honor. Under Crosby, the judge gave a sentence that had to be analyzed under why the judge did that. That decision was subject to review by this court, whereas here there was really no conscience, thought, effort, analysis, no traditional sentencing considerations come into play here. It's just a mandatory sentence.
What difference does that make? Either the sentence is cruel and unusual or it isn't.
Correct, Your Honor, which is why I believe that really both arguments dovetail somewhat.
Can we just make it practical for a minute? Isn't your cruel and unusual punishment argument that this sentence triggered by escape from conviction being listed as a violent felony when the underlying facts were simply not returning to the halfway house when he was supposed to do so, for that to trigger 8 years minimum mandatory is so grossly disproportionate to what he actually did that it's cruel and unusual punishment?
That is the defendant's argument, Your Honor. 8 years for essentially an AWOL violation or a curfew violation while constructive legal custody under the law pursuant.
And it's linked to your substantive due process argument, because it wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been classified, you believe, mistakenly as a violent offense.
Correct, Your Honor.
But didn't Crosby indicate that a 10-year sentence would not have triggered the grossly disproportionate analysis?
Your Honor, I see my time is up, absent my rebuttal. May I answer your question
sure.
and conclude? With respect to that, I think the real differentiation here is, at least under the Crosby rationale, there was independent decision-making made by the judge subject to abuse of discretion review, whereas here it's just a mandatory, calculated, mechanical sentence with no thought beyond the legislature's decision to call it violent, resulting in what we believe to be simply a ridiculous sentence for a curfew violation.
So if the trial judge had discretion and said, you've got this prior record for A, B, C, and D, and you are obviously not someone who, for public safety reasons, should be in the community, I impose 8 years, it would not be a constitutional violation?
It presents an entirely different legal analysis and appeal issue if it is a discretionary sentence through a orderly, deductive, logical court process arriving at the sentence. And the defense here is not asking for the case to be thrown out. The defendant acknowledges that he is still a habitual offender. He is still subject to zero to life if he were to be resentenced. However, it's just entirely different when you have that process occur, the independent decision making, as opposed to it's a violent offense, irrespective of the substantive nature of the conduct, the sentence arises mechanically. There's no independent decision making.
You want to save the balance of your time?
I do, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Justice. Your Honor, may it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the State. Section 4201C is a list. It's a list of triggering events, crimes that can trigger enhanced punishment under our habitual offender statute. Please excuse my voice. That's all it is a list, whether it was called triggering events or the purple list or violent felonies, it's a list. The legislature is presumed to have understood what it was putting these offenses on the list for. It was to enhance punishment for people who had committed various crimes.
It's a list, but they say these are designated as violent felonies. So it's a list distinct from other possible crimes that could have been listed, correct?
That's correct.
One would assume that they would have analyzed each of these to determine whether they were, in fact, violent or not. Now, how is failing to return to a halfway house after curfew a violent felony?
Your Honor, the legislature was presumed to have decided that these offenses were relevant for triggering the Minuteman part of 4214A, that does whether or not they are actually violent or nonviolent is not really the issue. The issue is whether those offenses should trigger something
So it would be rational then for a legislature to designate something that's clearly not violent as a violent felony simply because it's a list and has no more meaning behind it than that. They could have put overdue library book on this list, and that would have been, because it's simply on the list, a rational designation of overdue library book as a violent felony.
No, Your Honor. The idea is that the list needs to be, it needs to be a list of, that rationally these types of offenses should trigger the Min Man, and that these offenses are considered especially dangerous or violent. There are other offenses on this list that are not inherently violent. Drug crimes have been labeled violent, that possession of drugs is violent.
So this is a form of newspeak, at least as what the word violent means then.
In a sense, yes. This list is a determination by the General Assembly that these particular crimes, for one reason or another, should merit special attention and trigger minimum mandatory sentencing.
Well, if you were to group them as categories, wouldn't you find that they're inherently violent? Now, we've got case law after case law that says drug crimes, because of the association of weapons with the acquisition and sale of drugs, are violent crimes.
Yes, Your Honor,
for burglary, for example, burglary first and burglary second are listed as violent because of the nature of entering someone's home after dark for the purpose of stealing from them, and entering and harming someone or entering armed with a weapon implies violence, but burglary third isn't there.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, historically, since escape in all of its forms has been considered, like burglary, inherently dangerous. In fact, it's under an exceptional category in Sentac for that very reason, where they note that the peculiar nature of escape charges, which may be considered as deserving aggravated punishment, even though they are primarily nonviolent in nature.
But they don't address the issue, after calling them nonviolent in nature, doesn't address the issue of whether they should be designated as violent felonies for the purpose of triggering the habitual offender status sentencing, does it?
Well, they've been designated as violent within Sentac itself because of the aggravated situation of flaunting judicial and state authority by failing to conform once they've already been convicted. This is not someone who just, although counsel would like to refer to it as a curfew violation, this is not. This is someone who left the custody after he had been convicted of a violent felony and went out into the community without authority to do
what
so.
What was his sentence to the halfway house, or his transfer to the halfway house, was the result of what charge against him?
He was there for an assault second, Your Honor.
Was that the one before the escape after conviction?
Yes. Yes, he was serving an assault second sentence at the time.
Did he ever wander back into custody? Or?
No, he did not, Your Honor.
I realize that a week passed, but at the end of the week, he didn't show up again. He was arrested, right?
That's correct.
Which puts it a little bit different than missing your curfew.
That is correct.
To what extent can 4201C incorporate other definitions? It's the 4214A says violent felony as defined in 4201C. Let's assume hypothetically that this particular statute had several whereas paragraphs that precede the escape after conviction definition and describes why they're going to graduate the penalties involved and say, whereas a simple walk away is not violent, but a walk away that involves the use of a weapon or involves violence or whatever, that those are violent, and therefore we are, the General Assembly, are going to have enhanced penalties for those. Can that definition within the statute itself be incorporated into 4201C? In other words, what does as defined in 4201C mean? Is it just the list? Or if a statute on the list subdivides crimes between violent and nonviolent, does it reach that?
It is simply the crimes on the list. The legislature certainly could have, if they had wanted to, said this statute, but only as to C and B felonies, but they chose not to.
Doesn't that create a problem of overbreath? There was a decision, and unfortunately I can't remember the name, by the United States Supreme Court in the 1970s that held in effect that where a legislature criminalizes conduct by making an irrebuttable presumption about that conduct that's at odds with the objective reality, is irrational and a violation of substantive due process. Isn't that what's happening here? That is, can it be argued that what the legislature has done by including escape after imprisonment in 4201C is to create an irrebuttable presumption that all escapes are violent, whereas in fact they're not inherently violent, and some may not be violent at all, although some may be. Doesn't that create a problem of both irrationality and overbreadth as far as the nonviolent portions are concerned?
No, Your Honor. The fact that it's on this list in its entirety and that all levels of escape after conviction are included is perfectly rational. Any type of escape puts the community in danger.
Well, if it were perfect, that sort of puts the rabbit in the hat. Why is it perfectly irrational? That is perfectly rational, excuse me.
Thank you, Your Honor.
There is a category or a subset of escapes that are not violent.
Well,
yet the legislature is saying they are.
Well, that's the same idea about the burglaries where the legislature has determined that's a dangerous situation can lead to violence. It's rational to take certain crimes that, even if the violence doesn't happen, are inherently subject to violence going to happen, and put that on the list. These are particular crimes that should have enhanced punishment. And that's what this list is about, enhanced punishment.
So you're saying that because it was found either by Syntac or by the legislature or both, that escape sometimes involves the risk of violence, that risk is enough to deem the entire crime as a violent crime, at least for purposes of sentencing enhancement?
Certainly. These are people who have already been convicted of a crime. This is not someone escape after conviction. These are convicted felons who are now at loose in society when they should not have been.
Well, but when you say they should not have been, it was the Department of Correction that placed the individual here at a halfway house, saying you should be in the community. You have served your assault offense to the degree where we're in attempting to reintegrate you into the community. Isn't there a rational assumption that the Department of Corrections doesn't place people at halfway house and release them into the community because they have an expectation they're going to conduct themselves violently? I mean, they make the decision there's no risk, or they wouldn't put them in the halfway house in the first place. And isn't that the reason that the legislature defines three kinds of escape after conviction, two of which in the definition include violent acts, and the third does not? But somehow even the third, which isn't self-defined with the violent act, either implicitly or explicitly, shows up in the same list with the two that do. How is that rational?
Well, in the first instance, that Your Honor originally said that this is the attempt to rehabilitate people into society, and I stress that word, attempt, that the Department of Correction does not necessarily move people because they want to. It's because of a court order sometimes. Sometimes not. Sometimes it is their decision to have flowed them down. Other times it's not. There is an attempt, certainly, and the hope that people will conform to the rules. However, that does not mean that the Department of Correction feels entirely comfortable sending these people out unsupervised into the community. It's a requirement. It's part of the reintegration into the community.
Well, in this case, I thought the person was off working and didn't, and there was a dispute about when he clocked out until they could decide whether he had escaped. So as far as being in the community, when you're working at a job, you're pretty much in the community, aren't you?
Certainly. But the ability to conform to the rules of whatever placement level you're on in probation or as the quasi-custodial of level 4 is important in that reintegration process.
No one's really arguing that failing to return on time while you're being given the privilege of placement at the halfway house doesn't require the application of a rule, a form of discipline for failing to conform. I haven't heard that argument. The argument, as I understand it, is the consequence of placing this fact situation within a list of violent crimes under circumstances that triggers an 8-year minimum mandatory non-discretionary sentence by a trial judge is irrational.
Well, Your Honor, there are two parts to this. There is the part about escape after conviction, and then there is the habitual offender statute. And the habitual offender statute, which has consistently been found to be constitutional, is to prevent recidivism. And this is someone who qualified. He agreed he had qualified. He had prior escape after conviction. He had prior violent felony. This man knew he pled guilty, agreed he was habitual eligible, and then was unhappy with his sentence. That's what this came down to. This is designed to punish people who are repeat offenders. He was a repeat offender. He had criminal history going back 20 years.
Can I interrupt for a second? Is the problem here, if there is one, with the term violent? In other words, if the habitual offender statute said that if you are convicted of any of the following list of crimes, then you are in a position where you have to get the enhanced sentence, and all levels of escape were on that list, but the list didn't enumerate those crimes as being violent crimes, would that eliminate any constitutional argument about whether this is a due process violation?
Yes, Your Honor. And that was the point I tried to make originally, was that the name of the list really isn't the important issue here.
So is there any limit to what could be put on that list? Could, as the Chief Justice referred to earlier, overdue library book be on that list?
There would have to be a rational relationship to a legitimate government interest. Yes, there are limits. There are due process limits to what could go on anything. But once again, if there is a rational basis for that, then whatever they want to put on that list, the General Assembly can put on that list.
So, as I understand your argument, it's rational for the General Assembly to do this because no matter how you've escaped, whether it's from the prison, the halfway house, once you're out in the community when you shouldn't be there, and just as there is a potential for violence and the two categories of burglary that are on the list, taking someone back into custody when they shouldn't be out in the community has such a high potential for violence that it's rational to have it on the list also.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the state's position. And as to the Eighth Amendment issue, I'll move to that unless there are other questions. This is not a case that even meets the threshold basis of gross disproportionality. Even if this were a nonviolent crime not designated as violent anywhere, it would still be subject to 0 to 8 years. He got 8 years. If there had been no habitual and the judge had sentenced him to 8 years, there would be no issue. And that's where it is here. He could have received up to life.
What would the Senate guideline have been for the sentence under those circumstances?
With a prior violent felony, 0 to 8 would be what the Sentac would recommend. He did have prior felonies, so he was not presumptively going to get the lowest level.
But under that circumstance, the judge, though he or she could sentence to 8 years, would it have been minimum mandatory? And would the judge have had discretion to make it less than 8 years after listening to an argument about, despite the earlier offenses, after all, the Department of Correction had determined that he merited halfway house status, not continued incarceration. It was time to try to reintegrate him in the community. He simply failed to cooperate in the reintegration. Would that, you think, have any effect on the judge's sentence?
Those things could have had an effect on the judge's sentence. However, this court, in reviewing sentencing, will not delve into a sentence that is within the statutory maximum unless there is a reason. And
no, I understand that, but I take the other side's point to be the distinction here that's troublesome for whether it's substantive due process or Eighth Amendment reasons is that here there was no opportunity for a sentencing judge to exercise any discretion at all, and that under those circumstances, this is cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, in fact, there was discretion. It just began at 8 years and could have gone on up to life. So the judge did have discretion, however, in a different range.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and that's a good point that you make. I concede that. But if we were to put it in the terms of trying to distinguish between what the sentence would have been without habitual offender, it would have been 0 to 8. Habitual offender, it's 8 to life.
Yes.
That's a significant difference.
And he is an habitual offender, and he agreed to that, and he pled based on that, saying he agreed that he was an habitual offender.
Yeah, well,
we that's
know why
we have that statute.
And we know why he's an habitual offender, because they put not coming back to the halfway house on time on a list of violent felonies.
He understood that there was a minimum 8 years?
Yes.
Well, why aren't all the arguments waived?
This was he's challenging the statute itself, not his, you know. That's a good point. It was raised at sentencing, this issue about the constitutionality, and based on that, the state did not argue waiver because it was raised in the trial court. However, he did plead, and he had a knowing plea, and it said specifically in the plea that he agreed that he was a bit eligible. So that, in my mind, forecloses any Eighth Amendment issue in any case.
Well, were both of the arguments raised at trial, and because there are two issues. One is the designation of this as a violent felony, and the other is the consequences of the sentence. And Mr. Leger was saying, we have this list for purposes of finding someone to be a habitual offender, and he acknowledged that his crime was on the list. He was a habitual offender. If he didn't challenge that, then the consequence of what he pled guilty to was a minimum of 8 years. And was his real argument, I plead guilty to this, and I realize there's a minimum of 8 years, but the minimum violates the Eighth Amendment. Was that his only claim, or was his claim that he never should have been a habitual offender because this should never have been characterized as a violent crime?
The record, as my recollection of the record, Your Honor, it was that the claim was that this should not have been included in the list. That was the claim.
All right. So he made both arguments. I'm pleading guilty to this crime, but it should not be characterized as a violent crime. And if it was properly characterized, I would not be a habitual offender.
It wasn't phrased precisely that way, but that would be a fair reading of it, Your Honor. If there are no other questions.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
May I proceed? I want to address a couple very important points. Defendant pled because, consistent with counsel's duties, this is the only issue in this case. There was no defense. There was no good faith basis to litigate, to have a trial. The argument was, is the sentence going to be fair? Counsel brought it up orally at sentencing because there were procedural events. The defendant had filed a motion pro se to withdraw his plea and had taken some action. Counsel did not take any action until after that was denied, and defendant affirmatively wanted counsel to continue representing him, which occurred at sentencing. The court graciously allowed counsel to make an argument with respect to the result here just being irrational and unconstitutional. To the extent waiver's in play at all, counsel suggests that these constitutional issues are always in play. Substantive due process and cruel and unusual is in play. I don't think I would suggest that a defendant can't waive a cruel and unusual claim and stipulate to something being cruel and unusual. That's a decision for the court ultimately. I would request that the court look at 11 Del C 2014, which counsel failed to put in his briefs. It's a generic statute talking about the goal to differentiate upon reasonable grounds serious and minor offenses. And this statute and substantive due process gives this court the power to really look at this and decide, is this really appropriate, fair, rational, what happened here?
Are you suggesting that this form of escape shouldn't be a felony, because felonies are traditionally considered to be serious offenses? Should this now be a misdemeanor and the General Assembly got it wrong?
No, Your Honor. The defendant has conceded it's a felony. The defendant acknowledged that he was subject to habitual offender.
I understand, but you just finished suggesting that based upon another statute, there's a distinction between serious and non-serious crimes. And isn't this crime serious by definition, if you will, because it's a felony?
The question for the court ultimately is what caliber of seriousness and what punishment's appropriate for the offense. And I cite 201 subsection 4 because I believe that's really an extension, codification of the substantive idea of rationality and a reasonable relationship between what's going on. With respect to Justice Holland's comments, the defendant acknowledged he was habitual eligible. The defendant's argument is that he's not subject to the violent felony minimum mandatory, that he should be able to make the sentencing argument that this conduct rates the suggested sentence that counsel will make under the facts and circumstances, which aren't relevant for this court. With respect to Sentak, we have a 30, 60, 90-day penalty for first, second, and third offense of this charge, which jumps to the eight-year minimum mandatory when you're habitual eligible. Sentak is completely inconsistent with how to treat this. It says it's nonviolent. It says it's aggravated. It creates very low penalties for the offense absent habitual offender, but then we have a minimum mandatory 8 years when you're habitual offender.
Thank you, Mr. Luger.
Thank you.
Thank
have
you,
nice
counsel.
Day,
we'll take the case under advisement and recess.